Lecture 8, Easter Seminar. Resurrection. Non-possessively living in the now. Non-possessively living in the now. Can everyone see the little red light here?
Nope.
Yes.
If I bend over to them. Yeah. Non-possessively living in the now. Okay. Possession of the past denies the present. The allness is everything. Non-possession living in the now. So here we are. Resurrection is a very delightful, wonderful, positive, magnificent thing. It's something that sparkles our eyes and makes the apple Pam Dowdy say howdy. It's a wonderful thing. Non-possessively living in the now is something that is so unique, it is so strange, so unusual, that there are very few people on the face of the earth who are demonstrating that, non-possessively. In the first place, we know about the simple possession, my house, my car, my clothes, my mother, my father, my sisters, my brothers, my family, my shoes, you know, my dog, my cat, my telephone, and my room, my bed, my sheet, my pillowcase. And you see, we have all of these things that we possessively hold. Now you say, well, that's not really possession. That's just sort of a name that's given to things because it is something that we use. My car, you know. My wife. Ooh-wee! Isn't that exciting? My wife. My husband. My children. My children. I own them. I possess them. They are up for my beck and call, whatever I choose to have them do. Well, now, is that really what we want to do? Is that really how we want to look at the world around us? How we want to consider things? Well, it may not be as we would ostensibly say. Certainly we wouldn't want to be that way, but we are. We are, because this is our makeup. How do we train ourselves not to be possessed? When you say, let me alone, you don't want to be disturbed. Well, who said that's your body? Who said that's a body that you possess? That's merely a body you're using at this stage of life. Now, what if you give your body to be used as a scientific device after your death, so that science can have all of your organs and so forth and work with them to perhaps save other lives and things like that. Is that your body? Is that your heart that's in that other person? Is that your lungs, your gallbladder, your whatever's, you know? Are those yours that are there? Well, it may have been up to the point that they left your body. When they left your body, they were nobody's. They belonged to the universe. And then when they were transplanted into another person, then they became that other person's to use. And if that other person was not a happy person, and he rejected your transplant, then he didn't like you. He didn't like your organ. He didn't like what you have given to him, or what was given to you, him, by whoever gave it. Now, possession seems a very subtle thing and a very faithful thing, because it's something that if we allow ourselves to be working in that area, we are causing ourselves to be very unhappy, to be very demanding of conditions and circumstances, and it's not what we want to do. It's not what we want to do because it's not important to us. Owning things is not important to us. Although people say, that's my house. What are you doing in my house? Well, your house was just sold to me. How could it be sold to you? It's my house. Well, you didn't pay the payments on the house, and the court repossessed the house, and then it was sold again, and I bought it. But you can't buy my house. Well, you don't own it anymore. But it's my house. I lived in it for 30 years. that doesn't make any difference. It instantly became somebody else's house the minute you didn't make the payments on it, the minute you didn't keep it up. Well, I had paid it off two or three times. Yes, but you borrowed money on it again so that you could, you know, use the money for whatever you wanted to use it, and you didn't keep up the payments. So the house went for sale. Well, that's not fair. You know? Now, think about how we do that. Think about in the days gone by, in the industrial age as it was coming into being, parents would sell their children to factories, to people, so that the children could work in the factories. Because here these 7, 8, 10-year-old children could do work in the factory and could be just fed and housed and clothed, and they were just little robots to be worked. And this went on for many years. And it was not frowned upon by anyone. No one thought that that was a terrible thing, the having little children work like that and slave like that. Today that goes on over in China, in Korea, it goes on in Thailand, it goes on in many other countries of the world. It's quite common for child labor to be done that way. Now, Nike was using child labor for a time, and people got wind of it, and they publicized it, and Nike had to find a different supplier for parts of its shoes because it could not use that one which had child labor. Now, they presumed they didn't know it, but they did. But you see, these children don't even own their own bodies. Their bodies belong to somebody else to whom it was sold. Their mind was sold. Their being was sold. They had no individual possession at all. They were nothing. They were just little robots, like you'd have dogs in a dog race, and you keep them in a kennel, and then you race these dogs in the race, and then you put them back in the kennel again. And then when the time for the race comes, you fed them, then you put them out on the track again, and they run the track, and then you put them back in the kennel. They don't get any affection. They don't get any loving. They don't get anything. Maybe they're bred so that they'll have more dogs to put in the kennel to run in the races. These are again, quite common. Now, where does possession begin and end? Well, let's know that possession never began. That's just terminology that was used to describe an activity. My house, it's the house that I have purchased, and I have the right to use it so long as I keep up the payments. If I paid for the house free and clear, then I can theoretically use it forever as long as I pay the taxes. And if I don't pay the taxes, I can lose the house too. So, you see, the house does not belong to me. It could be just a fluke of payments, and I would not have that house anymore. We are so into possessiveness. We're so into owning things and saying that it's my foot, my house, my hand, my world. And as we say these things, what are we doing? We're giving away control of ourselves to those things. What do we want to say about things that we speak about with a possessive attitude of mind? What we want to say is, this is a body that I am using. And you say, well, that's so stilted. No, this is a body that I am using. This is a body that I am using and enjoying, and a body that I am taking part in and having it be mine. And it's a lovely thing. It's a lovely body. And I am very happy with it. But it's not my body. It's a body of the universe. It's a body that was created by God, that was created by the infinite. Well, you see, then we want to step that next step. Who is the infinite? The infinite is you. The infinite is me. God is you. God is me. Okay, now, if God is you and God is me, can you imagine the infinite creative cause over everything having any thought ever of possession? These are my people. The Jews had God thinking that they were the chosen people of God. The Jews had God thinking, having the people thinking that God was their one God. and that God belonged to nobody else. And of course, we say the God of the Hebrews, the God of the Jews, the God of the Hindus, the God of the Mohammeds, you know, the Christian God. We say all these things right away, labeling and possessing them. How can there be one God, and yet there are so many individual possessors of that one God? And each possessor dresses that one God in whatever gown or robe or whatever outer picturing that they feel that is looks good on the God. Now, have you ever noticed the interesting things the Hindus have done with the God? What is the God that they've given the elephant head to? You notice that? What is the God that they've given all of these other beautiful expressions to? They call each a God. And do they have one universal God? Some people say they do. I have not been privy to that information, but some people say they do. How about the Romans and the Greeks? Did they have one God? Or did they have many gods? And was there the big God over it, Jupiter, you know? What was Jupiter over? And you see, when you start thinking about this, you start thinking of the possession that goes into that. That's our God. Pray to your God. And when you get down to it, with a world filled with so many gods, so many replications of or indications or replicas of a God, you say, what really is God? What really is it that they're praying to? What really is it that they're doing? And in every religion, in every philosophy, in every psychology of every country in the world, people get back to the one thought that it is the divine within themselves. And so they become aware of the divine within themselves. Now, these little children that are sold into slavery or labor, slave labor or whatever you call it, and these little children, they have no God inside of themselves. They have no divinity inside of themselves, as far as the people who are in charge of them say. However, these little children have as much divine God inside of them as anybody else. Now, how do they remain in such a slavery condition and yet have some sort of attitude of contentment or belongingness or beingness? Stop and think. Slavery in the world has been going on for virtually forever, and it perhaps will go on still forever. Not that it's a desirable thing, but it will go on. Because I will name a few slaveries that you hadn't thought about, perhaps. Men are enslaved to the political party. Men are enslaved to running for this president or that president. I'm voting for this, and I'm voting for that. You know, you're voting for the wrong one. You're enslaved to this irrational attitude, and you are possessed by it. We are possessed by all these things. Now, you say, Herb, you're doing a lot of talking about possession, but when are you going to start talking about non-possession? Well, let's start right now. Non-possession is when you make one statement and you hold to this statement an infinite number of times a day. And that statement, can anyone tell me what it is? And I'll start you out. All is
in divine order.
All is in divine order. When these children are in slavery, you say, all is in divine order, and mean it. Mm-hmm. And if you are consistent in it, you know what will happen? As Jesus said, they'll break the binds of their prison and free them. Free the prisoners, Jesus said. He didn't say for what crimes or for whatever, but free the prisoners. Free all those who are bound into slavery. And He said that. He taught that 2,000 years ago. I mean, and we're finally getting the message. But free those enslaved, and all is in divine order, would free everyone. All is in divine order would free us from the slavery of illness. All is in divine order would free us from the slavery of poverty. All is in divine order would free us from the slavery of any idea which would limit us. Now you see, we are possessed with the idea that we can only grow so far because the genes, chromosomes, hormones, and what have you in our body and from our heritage, from our parents, grandparents, and wherever, limit us to a certain extent. Now, we're possessed by that. And the way to not be possessed by that is to say all is in divine order. And you say, well, Herb, you sure have made a simple solution to a very complex problem. You have made a very simple solution. Now, who can say all is in divine order and experience all is in divine order when they're still in slavery? If all of the Jews who were put into the camps, the death camps, if all of them had on the tip of their tongue from the very point of their pickup, all is in divine order, what would have happened? I'm sorry?
Something would have happened.
Something would have happened. Hitler would have changed his mind.
Yeah.
It's not worth this effort to keep these people just to kill them.
Yeah.
It's not worth the effort. Hitler could have been put out of business and somebody else put in business who says, hey, I like the Jews. Let's put them back in power. Let's put them back into, and boom, like that, it could be done. When all is in divine order, it doesn't have to have any particular manner that it is brought into being. It is just a matter that you put it in principle, you put it in the law, you put it in motion, and it happens. Now, you have any problem in your life, and you say all is in divine order. Dorothea has her Jeep, and her Jeep has a little problem. And she says, oh dear, somebody stole my headlight. Oh dear, I'm going to have to do this. Oh dear, this is not nice. Oh dear. And so she goes out and she allows herself to put in a foreign light in her Jeep, which is not matching the color and the scheme of the rest of the Jeep. And so right away it stands out like a sore thumb. She should have put the same light in there with the same coloring, even if she had to paint it, you know, have it painted, so that it would look exactly the same, so it would not say to people, hey, that's a removable light. Let's remove it. You see, she doesn't want that in her consciousness. So what she does is once she has her vehicle in the way that she wants it, and even before, she says, all is in divine order. I surround my Jeep with my pure white light of love, and all its ways are peace, and all its paths are pleasantness. You see, when we get away from this possession stuff, that's my Jeep. Somebody stole my light from my Jeep. Somebody did this, somebody did that. Hey, wrap your Jeep in your pure white light of love, and what people will do will be to cover it with diamonds for you, you know? People will come and do beautiful things. They'll love it too, just like you do, because they'll feel the aura of your Jeep as a radiating center of harmony, peace, love, beauty, and goodness. You know what I mean? This is what happens when we say all is in divine order. This is what happens when we put the cause in motion for everything to be revealed. And no possession. My Jeep. You say the Jeep. Okay? Dorothea? What did you say to us when you donated us the church? You said, you now own the church, right? Did you say that?
Yes.
And who owns the Jeep?
The church still.
So the church owns the Jeep. So you don't own the Jeep. So for you to say, my Jeep is not correct. Now you can say, I use the church's Jeep. That's perfectly okay. No one's going to say you shouldn't do it. No one's going to say you shouldn't wear it out. No one's going to say you shouldn't do other good things. But everyone is going to say, if it's your Jeep, and someone is ripping you off on your Jeep, you must have a very bad consciousness. You must have be a very poor, what do you say, mother or poor parent of your Jeep. But when it's the church's Jeep, then you say, I surround the church's Jeep with my pure white light of love, and all its ways are peace, and all its paths are pleasantness. And it's great, but you see, it gets it out of your possession. Now, what about all the things in your house? Are they belonging to you or the church, or do they belong to all is in divine order? What do they belong to? And I'm not trying to say anything different than what I'm saying in words here, but they're not yours. You don't want to possess them. You want to say, these are God's. These are delightful things that I'm privileged to use for the next 100 years, you know? Hey, don't knock it. Is your body whole and perfect?
Oh, absolutely.
Is your body ideal?
Yes.
Is your body ready to take you for another 100 years?
Yes.
All right. Well, see, don't say, oh, you know, because that is the kind of remark that people who are not aware of their divinity say, you know? Mm-hmm. And you're aware of your divinity. You are aware of the magnificence that you are. But you see, when you're possessed by your body, you say, oh, I don't want to live in this body like this for another 100 years. Well, hey, what you have done to your body during your lifetime is absolutely amazing. You have, what do we say here, resurrected your body any number of times, you know? You've resurrected, let's see, you are 800 years old right now, so 800 years times 365, so you have resurrected your body 800 times 365. Now that is really quite a resurrection. That is really quite beautiful. And sometimes you did a good job, sometimes you did not such a good job, because you were not paying attention, you know? So, every time you resurrect your body, you say, all is in divine order. Every morning when you wake up, you say, all is in divine order. And every night when you go to sleep, now I lay me down to sleep, I hope the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I hope the Lord my soul to take. What a silly thing to say. What you want to say is, all is in divine order. God, we've got a great body here, and it's ready to have a good night's sleep, and let's release it to its wonderful sleep, and let it awaken in the morning, filled with energy and power and vitality, ready for an exciting day. You see? Then the possession gets lost. Because could you say anything unkind about God's body? Not very well. We want to recognize that this is God's body. This is the temple of the living God. That's what we say, don't we?
Yes.
And what a joke we make of it when we say, that's my body. It's the temple of the living God. And of course, we're the living God, but we don't want to say that because we still think that we're nothing. We still think that we're limited. We still think that we are in many ways imperfect. Imperfect? Dorothea, you imperfect?
No.
You don't think that, do you?
Oh, no.
Oh, I hope to pick as a pig. No way. Sylvia, are you imperfect?
No.
Ingeborg, are you imperfect?
I am perfect.
I am perfect.
Ellen? I am perfect.
Herb? Oh, when you look at me, you know what perfection is. Okay, I live in my ideal spirit, mind, and body. I live in my ideal spirit, mind, and body. You're right, it sort of sunk in the pocket a little. I live in my ideal spirit, mind, and body. And that's the big thing for all of us. We live in our ideal spirit, mind, and body. And this is a program that we want to express. This is a program that we want to live, that we want to be. We want to release all the possessiveness, all the feeling that we are owned by our body, we're owned by anything, and we want to be aware that we are now alert, awake, enthusiastic about life in every beautiful thing. And we are. This is a fabulous thing for all of us. And all we have to do is to start putting the cause in motion by saying, all is in divine order. Can you say all is in divine order?
Yes.
All is in divine order.
All is in divine order.
That's right. And when does it start?
Now. Right, but
there is only
in
now.
Order.
It's already in divine order. It's the only way it is. And you see, that's the beauty of these things. When we live aware of our divinity, when we live aware that we live in our, yes, we live in our ideal spirit, mind, and body, we live in that wonderful expression, and that is what it's all about. Are you putting your hands behind your ears because I should speak louder?
No.
Oh, okay. So think about that, that all is in divine order. All is in divine order. The more that we say all is in divine order, and the more we put the cause in motion for our experience of this non-possession of our life. Possession of the past denies the present. My experience as a child, my experience as my mother, you know, or my brothers and sisters, or my world, or my house. Have you ever gone back and looked at the house you used to live in? You said, that's my house? And it's not your house anymore. It's somebody else's house. It may have been a house in which you live, but now it's somebody else's house. And we still like to say it's mine. And Mrs. DeSwart, she lived next door to my house, you know. And Mr. Kudmich, he lived next door to my house. And my house was on 1777 North 83rd Street in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin, you see. And we get so possessed by that. I can see the house because I'm possessed by it. Now, when I can say, our house, that's a little better, but it's still possession. When I can say, the house I lived in, now that's a lot better. Come, let me show you the house that I lived in. Let me show you the neighborhood that I lived in, our old neighborhood. Let me show you the people who used to live there. You know, we got pictures of them and so forth. But using the sort of imperfect the, it makes it feel just a little weak. And when we read stories and books that have a lot of emotion in it, it's a lot of personal possession. As we watched that show, Neverland, there was so much personal possession in there because this is our house. And I enjoyed the young man who was about 13 or 14, and his grandmother was saying that this other person couldn't come into the house. And the boy says, this is our house, not yours. You are visiting here. This is our house. It belongs to Mother and us. And we want that person to come into our house. This is our house. Now, if he had said, this is the house of the family, whatever the last name is, this is the house that we have, it would lose so much of its power in telling the story, because the possession makes it such a magical thing, such a powerful thing, you know. And yes, and in that way, it gives possession sort of a nobility, and that makes it a mistake. What does the king say? This is my kingdom. This is my country. This is my land. These are my people. Mm-hmm. And what do you say? You're born in Switzerland and Germany and Italy and France and America, wherever you're born, and you say, this is my country. And when we teach the song to people all over the world, what do we say?
I bless
America, land that I love. I stand beside her and guide her through the night with the light from above, within. But you see,
at the end.
Yeah, but we want to be very careful in teaching this, that we don't teach possession, we teach presentation. Let me present you with my body. And so, what is it, Arnold Schwarzenegger? gets up on stage and says, let me present you with my body and my muscle. And he shows off in such glory because he has worked very hard on developing them. And he has done a good job. He's a most notable person. But it's a possession. It's a possession. And now, does he think that the United States is his country? Do you think he might have a test case and attempt to run for president and see if the people vote him in contrary to the rule? Do you think they could vote him in contrary to the rule? If the majority of the voters wanted him to be president, he could be president. Because the rules are only made to be guidelines for the people. And if the people en masse choose to change the rules, which they should do, I don't mean they should change that particular rule, but if ever people en masse desire to change the rule, what has been the rule? The rule has been that women do not vote. Remember that rule?
Oh, yes.
And they changed it, didn't they?
Yes.
What has been the rule? That liquor and alcohol is forbidden, is prohibition, forbidden for the country. And they changed that rule. You see, these rules are there as guidelines. And when the people choose to have them be different, then they are made different. And so you see, when you say that Arnold Schwarzenegger, not having been born in America, couldn't be the president, that is a very weak rule. Because it could be changed if the people of the nation felt so confident in him. And you know, I think they would. I think they would because he's crazy. Because he is so definite on the things he does. And let's say he has basically such good principles that he lives by, that it would be the type of thing that the people of the country would love to have, you know?
Yeah.
Now, you look at all the other candidates, and what do? They're usually weak sisters who are ruled by the party, who are ruled by the people who put them in power, and they have to go along with their desires and with their requests in it, whatever way it may be. You understand that? So, you see, possession. They are possessed by their party. And perhaps Mr. Schwarzenegger would not be possessed by his party, or maybe he would. Maybe he would fall into the same trap that everyone else has done. Although from his history and from his experience and from his activities of his life, it would seem like he might not fall into it. You fall into the trap so easily of saying, my house, my car, my dog, my people, my world. And we want to get away from that. You say, well, Herb, what do we put in this place? All right. What do we put in this place? I do not have an easy answer for you on that. We attempted to have Katrina create for us a positive dictionary, a dictionary only of positive words, and she worked on it diligently for quite a while and found it a most impossible task. Not because there were not a lot of positive words, but because many of the positive words had to have a negative word define its positivity. And so that became very strange. What is the positive of can? It's being able to do. And where would you define some word with a negative attitude? How do you define to not do? You know, if you want to not do something, do not do something. And how do you define that without saying not? Mm-hmm. How do you define...
Avoid.
I'm sorry.
Avoid.
Yeah, well, that's not to. You see, that's a negative word, to avoid. Now, I want to avoid that tree up ahead. What I want to do is drive around that tree up ahead. Now, you see, it's circuitous. We have to make a lot of words to say a given thing when we are taking our negative words that say it so curtly, shortly, and well.
That makes it so difficult. It's so easy to say
That's my house.
That's right.
That's the house I grew up when I was and you know, or whatever.
Now, you say, that's my house. And you mean, that is the house I grew up in. And the people listening to you, if they don't know, they will think you still live there when you say, that's my house. But if people know you, they will know you're saying, that's the house I used to live in.
Yeah, I actually didn't mean that specifically now. I just said, like Ellen would open the door and say, that's my office. That's the room in which I have my computer and do my daily work.
That's where I work. That's my office. But you see, it's the word my that is getting you in trouble there.
But if you leave it out,
you can say, and of course this is the same thing, that's Ellen's office. But Ellen doesn't say, that's my office. You see, what, Ellen?
I think I say very rarely my house, my office, and my car.
Very rarely you say my office, my house, and my car.
But I say my computer.
My computer, yeah.
That I say.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would say my trousers. And
yeah.
And my head and my ears. And these things I would say, yes.
Now, what we have to be careful about, and of course I could put this one easily on conference, because the other one, it takes a little extra effort to put it on conference. But I could put this on conference, and then our conversation together could be more easily listened to by our audience, whoever they may be. Now, what did you say about your office, Ellen?
I say that's where I work.
That's where I work. And what about your clothes?
There become personal.
There it becomes personal.
Yeah.
Why do your clothing become personal and your office is able to be impersonal?
I wonder.
You wonder?
Yeah.
Well, probably because the clothes you wear and the office belongs to the organization.
Yeah.
And you are using it. Now, when you leave the organization, you're not asked to give back your clothes, are you?
Actually, yes.
I say, you're not asked to. You should, according to the rules,
right.
But have we ever enforced those rules? Not very well. We haven't enforced those rules because it was not convenient and comfortable to do so. But when we look at clothing here that belonged, that were worn by other people, what do we say? Well, that's Anita's jacket,
yeah.
That's Anita's shirt, that's Anita's pants. And we look at other clothing, we say, those are Heinz's old shoes, you know. And we say, those are things that belong to other people. And what was it that you did with my favorite white snowsuit? You gave it away because it had bad memories and you wanted to give it away because you didn't want to keep those memories around.
Exactly.
And you see, what should we do with anybody's clothing who's not here any longer? We should dispose of it. Give it to the Salvation Army or somebody else who might dispose of it. Because if we keep it here, we're always going to say, those things belong to so-and-so. Now, what we're working on is building a consciousness of non-possession. And building a consciousness of non-possession is a complex thing. Very wonderfully complex. But it's only complex insofar as our habits keep us saying the same thing over and over again. Our habits keep us saying that it is my house, my car. I just recall at this moment on the attic staircase going up into the attic from the second floor of our house in Wauwatosa, I looked at the wall, and there was May's name, where she had written some little statement, and her name was there, that had not been painted in over 50 years. It had not been changed in over 50 years, because that was back in let's say, 40, 45. 45. Or actually, she did that before that. She did it in 43 or 2. And we were there in, 80, 70, 80, sometime. And what an experience. No, it was in 90.
In the 90s,
yeah. So that's a half a century, you know? Really amazing when you consider that that was there and no one ever chose to paint that particular wall because it was just the attic where just stuff is stored and where people did not think that they had to make it painted nice, you know? And it's really something. It's really something. But you see, it was our house. And we somehow retained that interest in our house with that picture there of that. And we told May about it, and she really remembered putting it there, which is very interesting too. Yeah. But you see, possession is something that if you can ever come up with a manner in which it can be worked on and released, tell us. Because it is a great thing to be able to do that. Non-possession is one of the four items that we work with in our unconditionally loving training. Non-possession, no judgment. What are the others now?
Untouchable.
And one-pointedness. Those are the four that we recommend people work with as they develop the ability to be unconditionally loving. Now, it's not just a matter of being unconditional. I guess that's pretty much of it too. But unconditionally loving, where you love everything without expecting anything back, and really mean it. You love everything without expecting anybody to respond to your generosity and your goodness. People who are philanthropic, they love to give money, they love to give things, but they also want credit for it. They want to have it taken off their taxes as a tax-exempt donation. You follow me?
Mm-hmm.
And now, that's nothing. Give it as a taxable donation, and then it really is something. Then it really is something beautiful. Now, the widow who gave her mite and was referred to in the Bible that she gave her little tiny bit to the church, they said she was so wonderful, and the rich man who gave so little of so much that he had was really not much at all. And this is foolish talk. This is foolish talk. If a widow has nothing and gives whatever she has of that nothing, she's foolish. She's foolish because you receive according to what you have. And if you have nothing, you get nothing. If you have the widow's mite, at least you get the widow's mite back. You follow me? This is a statement from the Bible. It's a statement from the teachings of Jesus. And there are so many irrational things that are brought out that we have to wake up to. And what we want to do is to be an absolutely, totally in charge person of all of our attitudes, of all of our thinking, of all of our ways of looking at things, and let go of possession of anything. Now, it's not hard for me to let go possession of the Miata because it's not in my name. It's in Stefan's name.
Yeah, because you anyhow like the Mercedes.
I anyhow like the Mercedes, and I should have gotten the Mercedes at the time I got it. But that's another story. But you see, the thing is, it's easy. I drive the Miata, and it has somebody else's name on it. And then I notice that Stefan's name also is on the White Expedition. So he was president at the time, and he had to buy these things, and he had to put his name down because they required an individual's name. And can you imagine the president of General Electric putting his name on every vehicle that they purchase, and then he is out of office the next year, and so all those vehicles are in his name. I mean, that seems a little ludicrous, doesn't it? That you must have an individual's name where the individual is not a corporation. The individual can die or change. And it is really strange how they play those games. But that's the games they play. We want to learn how we can live more non-possessively. And we live more non-possessively when we learn to give without letting anyone know that we're giving. So many people put notes on my desk and they want to sign the note so they get credit for having done the work the note entailed. Whereas if they would just put on there the person who is responsible for getting the information together, like, you're supposed to get me information on a student, and the student's name is in the file that Ingeborg has. And so you go and you get the details from the file and you bring them to me. And if you had said, this is from Ingeborg, who had it in her files, and so now you have it. But you say, but I did the work. I went to get it. I got it. And I'm responsible for it, and I should get credit for it. Well, if we want credit, we are possessed by the need for credit. Are you, and this is a tough question now, it's a question you're not going to come up with an easy answer. It's a question that's going to ripple you apart. It's going to make you very unhappy. Are you yourself? Are you your own name? Are you who you are? Or are you someone else?
I'm Peter and I like my name.
There you go. I am Peter and I like my name. Who are you? Are you the beautiful being that you are? Or are you someone else? Can you say, I like me?
Yes. I like me.
Can you say, I enjoy my company?
I enjoy my company.
Can you say, I am a beautiful being?
I am a beautiful being.
Can you say, she is a beautiful being?
She is a beautiful being.
Can you say, she is more beautiful than I am?
No.
Why can't you say that?
Because that's comparison.
Oh, and you cannot compare.
No.
But do we compare?
No, never.
Never. What do we do?
We just make
be myself and have fun. No judgment. No possession. We are absolutely fabulous beings. Now, are you really a fabulous being?
Yes.
Do you like yourself?
Yes.
Do you like me?
Yes.
Why?
Because I like myself.
Because I am your reflection. And you have beautiful, clear eyes.
And you have beautiful, clear eyes.
You have a beautiful consciousness through which you see only your highest and best at all times. And I am what you see. No, always remember, be yourself and have fun and claim the truth about yourself that you are divine and you are good and you are fabulous. And you are all right now. Because that's what you are.
Yeah.
That's what you are. So now, prepare a lovely supper and know that I will be there in an hour.
In an hour?
No, I will put this, upload it, and then it'll be done in an hour. But I'll come immediately.
Yes.
And we will share together. We will break bread together.
Wonderful.
Wonderful. So, have a lovely evening, and I love you. I love you.
I love you.